I have to say, it was coming into, when I was coming into town yesterday, I had not remembered this. I saw signs for Perimeter Institute, you know, on the highway, you know, you're going along, turn off the exit, and you saw a sign for the Perimeter Institute. But it was a sign in four different, you know, attractions in the area. Perimeter was at the bottom, and just above it was paintball. Okay, so I'm hoping that you picked the right spot when you came here. All right, anyway, so so today I'm going to talk about, and tomorrow, physics beyond the standard model. You've already heard actually a very nice introduction to this from Nima yesterday, and I'm going to repeat actually a few of the comments, because the more you hear them, the more you'll understand them, but also to augment in certain places, and then go directly to some new ideas. So that's the point. Okay. So, you've heard the motivation to go why. I noticed from all of the lectures, and you're going to hear it from me again, everyone has a slightly different perspective on this, but you'll find that they all tend to have overlapping versions. Why do you want to go beyond? The first obvious reason is that you have data that can't be explained. By the standard model. And you might be thinking, but wait a second, didn't Jim just tell me that everything can be explained by the standard model in the successful theory of all of the different experiments? Well, there's one big thing that is not explained in the standard model. Neutrino flavor oscillations. CIMN. And I have a habit, if I can't spell them for it, so when you see incorrect spellings, you can have fun and giggle at me. This is something that, well, it has been observed, the puzzles went all the way back to the 1960s, and in 1998, it was sort of definitive that there was clearly physics beyond the standard model in this context, the idea that neutrinos oscillate among their different flavors. It's now, completely and firmly established that this is true. And this is something that the standard model, as it's usually defined, does not include. Indeed, one of my exercises, had you had a session later today, would have been to think about exactly how you do this. Believe it or not, it's one of those things you can write down and think about just from effective field theory. What types of operators, what types of interactions would lead to neutrino mass? And as a consequence, there are different things that would potentially come out of it, and you can even contemplate the possibility that the mechanism of neutrino mass generation is something that the LHC itself could probe. It's not something that you usually hear about, but it is in fact a possibility, and you can find the range of parameters by which it works. It's a fun exercise. All right, I'll either give it today or tomorrow, depending on how the time goes. So data that cannot be explained by the standard model is obviously the first and obvious reason you have to go beyond. And this is an example of something that's actually happened. Okay. There's other things. Another big one is dark matter. We've all seen from cosmology that the data indicate we have not only not enough matter in the universe in the form of baryons to make up all of the matter that we observe, but in addition, we seem to have other components, dark energy, etc. It's possible that dark energy is, after all, just a cosmological constant that is extremely finely tuned. You can't do that with dark matter. You can't just go and tune some parameters and then end up with dark matter. It doesn't work. You can contemplate things like, oh, well, maybe it's baryons that are somehow dark. Well, but then that would conflict nucleosynthesis, which seems to indicate that you observe only 2% of the matter in baryons. You can contemplate that it's other things, even such as modified gravity. And there again, observations do not seem to support that, or at least they favor strongly something along the lines of dark matter. Okay. The best candidate for this is indeed particle dark matter. In the form of WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles. And I will tell you more about this. You heard it yesterday from Nima, and you're going to hear it again from me. And the more times you hear it, the more likely you will work on it, and then you'll uncover the problems, maybe the solution. So it will be great. Good. There are many other aspects to this, other things that can't be explained by the standard models. A list of them you can find in, for example, Jim Wells's lecture. So there is the issue of whether is dark energy actually a cosmological constant? Is it something else? The origin of the baryon asymmetry, et cetera. Okay? And there are many puzzles that you can go about like that. So this is one motivation to go beyond the standard model. Okay? The second one is that a new big experiment is coming, LHC. And you might say, well, OK, so a new experiment's coming. What does that have to do with beyond the standard model? The LHC is an experiment of a proton-proton machine at 14 TeV. It is a hadron machine, which means when the protons collide, they spit off lots of different things, jets, quarks, gluons, and it's a big mess. Okay? And it is something very hard to find and understand what's going on without very detailed analysis, both sort of on the side of trying to understand the standard model backgrounds, whether they match or not, as well as to try to understand if any of the bumps that you see in the spectrum are indeed new physics, or are they something to do with the detector, or are they something to do with background that you didn't quite understand properly. So this is a needle in the haystack. Experiment, OK, which means it gives our experimental friends lots of good things to do. But nevertheless, it's one that, in the end, requires guidance from theory to be able to pin down what they could or couldn't see. So for example, if you had a long-lived particle, a particle that lives long in comparison to the time scale between collisions, you could imagine a particle was created, and it flew out a little bit, and it decayed in the detector. And if it decayed out of sequence with the timing of the detector, someone might say, oh, that was a cosmic ray that went through. And then just reject it. So understanding the properties of what kinds of new physics could be there is vital to be able to interpret the data that comes from it. And this is coming online in less than 1 year, which is absolutely amazing for people who've been in this business for a while. Okay? So it's truly an exciting time. And there are a lot of people who contemplate physics beyond the standard model just for the purpose of looking at unusual signals and how well they could be found at the LHC. The last thing is, paper is not breaking the jar. The last thing is, the standard model is, after all, just another effective field theory. OK. And I'll explain more what I mean by this. So in that sense, there are many, if you like, strange or clunky aspects to the model. And you already know about some of them, the big one being electroweak symmetry breaking, in the sense of how is the scale stabilized, what is the origin of the discrepancy, or the hierarchy problem, the hierarchy between the weak scale, V electroweak, and say, M Planck or some higher scale. There is any number of other aspects that are puzzling. There is trying to understand how a parameter that you can write in the model, beta QCD, the strong CP phase, why this, the effective value, has to be less than about 10 to the minus 10 from electric dipole moments of the neutron, electron, and other atoms. This is puzzling. there's always the puzzle of three generations, or even more generally, flavor. We're only made out of one generation, and yet we've got these heavy ones that decay rarely, giving us all of these wonderful things to study at colliders. And there's even just the general issue of trying to understand why we have matter in these crazy representations. Yeah, so we've got color triplets, color singlets, SU2 doublets, and singlets. And relevant to the first question, maybe something else, you know, down here. Okay. So this is puzzling, and we don't understand that. The thing that I think is sort of most useful to go through at this stage is to try to link three of these pieces together. Because, you know, physics beyond the Standard Model is such a huge subject. There's enormous numbers of papers, enormous number of directions. And every one of them could take a lecture to go through. So it's much better to take something and concentrate on it. And I think the piece of it that's perhaps most interesting to go through is what I think is very likely a connection between this, okay, this, and this. Okay, so the original electroweak symmetry breaking, dark matter, and the LHC. And I think that the connection between these three is the one that will sort of yield the most fruit over the next some number of years. Okay. So that's what I want to do. And to do that, we need to go through a few things before I can actually go directly to talking about specific models of beyond the standard model. All right. Okay, so the first thing is, I need an eraser. After that, what's the problem with electroweak symmetry breaking? And you've seen this before. From the point of view of the standard model, there is, quote unquote, no problem, right? It is just the Higgs potential, after all. With a very important minus sign leading to the classic Mexican hat potential, where in field space, the Higgs, the minimum of the potential, has the Higgs acquiring an expectation value. This leads to electroweak symmetry breaking, to decay boson masses, to fermion masses, and is a very wonderful tight compact mechanism. But it does, after all, have this parameter in the model, the mass. This is an M. And by the way, if you can't read something, don't. It's just start to stare and say, what's that? I have that happen to me all the time. So, So the question is, why does this parameter take the size that it does? And how is it stable with respect to quantum corrections? Those are the two big questions with regard to electroweak symmetry breaking. But when I talked about the idea that the standard model is just another effective field theory, as opposed to some sort of, you know, really beautiful, important, and coherent package, it's important to stress that the nature of what I mean by that, in other words, the nature of what I mean by the standard model as just another effective field theory. So a long time ago, people thought that when you write down the standard model, you start to do rated corrections. And you know, you've seen some of them already, things like, say, here's a rated correction to the electron from a photon. And you do this calculation, you find an infinity, right? What do you do with the infinity? Well, you learn from field theory. You take the infinity, you sweep it into some parameter, you sweep it under the rug, if you like. And out of the finite part, or the logarithmic part of this, you get a real physical quantity. You get, you know, say, the effective charge of the electron. Okay. The same thing is true for, say, Gage bosons, right? So you saw, there we go. For, say, the W or the Z, the self-energies of these particles, something that Jim talked about in his lectures, again, something that is divergent, but nevertheless, you subtract away the infinity. And so a lot of people would say, oh, well, you know, the fact that the standard model is renormalizable, the fact that I can systematically take these infinities and sweep them into the parameters and somehow makes it special. That's the old way of thinking. Okay. And I think we're now well past that, but we're past that in a way that then leads precisely to the problem of this parameter. How are we past that? So these diagrams here, you know, if you went ahead and computed them, you would find, okay, so the electron mass is some, I'm going to stop racing with my hand. There we go. It's some bare mass plus a loop contribution. And I'm not seriously doing this, I'm just writing it down, so it's 16 pi squared. And then there's a divergence, which if I did it in dimensional regularization would be 1 over epsilon in 4 minus epsilon dimensions, epsilon goes to 0, plus some log, the log of pi squared. Okay, and there are numbers here. And a couple. And the same thing for this, except it's mw squared, 1 over epsilon. So this is the divergent part. This is the piece that we can subtract out. But absolutely. In my haste to write this down. Thank you. All right. So I'll use the erase. So what's the way to see this in a different light? And the different light is, of course, the light of effective field theory, which goes to Ken Wilson, who taught us that what you ought to do is integrate out the short distance physics to figure out the effects at long distance. And as a consequence, once you do this, once you impose a Wilsonian cutoff on the momentum, there are no divergences left over. They've all been swept into the high energy physics, namely the cutoff, okay? The cutoff theory. So what you have is a theory that you start with a bunch of parameters, say a Lagrangian with parameters, electron masses, couplings, okay, Higgs masses. And this becomes, after you impose a momentum cutoff, something in which the parameters now depend explicitly on the cutoff, plus now a series of higher dimensional operators. Let me get this right. Okay. I think the way I've done this, even though this is not right. So in four dimensions, starting at 5 and going all the way up. So once you impose a momentum cutoff and say, above this, the theory, I integrate out the high energy modes, whatever they are. They can be just the momentum modes of individual particles, or they can be actual physical particles that have mass. I result in the same Lagrangian again, with modified coefficients, modified parameters, as well as these higher dimensional operators. And that's it. So then this whole issue of infinities, the whole issue of these poles is gone. And you're left with then just this effective theory. This UV behavior, this UV divergence, is now, if you like, swept into the cutoff limits. Okay. If you then look at how these parameters change as a function of energy scale, it then becomes clear what the standard model really is in the end, namely the notion that it is just another effective field theory. So if I plot along axis here, energy, hopefully you can read that, and say a log scale, and a coupling, which may be dimensionful. Also say it's a log scale. What I've done is to take a theory and integrate out the high momentum modes. This has modified the coefficients of the theory that I have and added the series of higher dimensional operators. Ostensibly, at the scale of order lambda, all of these terms look like they're of the same order, because if this has, say, momentum dependence in it, and I go to very large energy, very large momentum, then these coefficients are order one. But as I lower the energy, these guys will drop off like a power law. Okay? The coupling strength just drops right off. Parameters which here were originally just dimension four operators, say couplings, the electromagnetic coupling, E, or the couplings of this of the other gauge groups, or Yukawa couplings, they will all run just logarithmically, hence this wonderful famous law. And so they have a behavior that may be something like this, where they sort of slope down, but very weakly with energy scale. They may do something like this. They start to go up a little bit, and then, namely the QCD coupling. But there's also the possibility that if there are parameters in the model which are dimensionful, well, they would scale with a positive power of lambda and do that. So what's the result of this? Well, forget about this for a moment, this possibility. There's, you integrate out the high energy modes, you get a series of higher dimensional operators. You go to low energies, and what results is only the dimension four and less parameters result in the theory have large couplings if I go sufficiently far from the cutoff. So the notion that the standard model is just another effective field theory is the statement that I integrate out high energy modes and I go to low energies and I'm resulting in just, okay, dimension four operators and lower. So that's the joy. That's the power of thinking about it in terms of an effective field theory. The problem is these things. This is why effective field theory makes it clear that, in fact, the Higgs mass squared is actually a problem and is actually sensitive to the cutoff scale of the theory. So just like there are 1 over epsilon poles in the divergence of mh squared, you might say, well, wait a second. I just subtracted away the infinities here for the electron mass or for Yukawa couplings or for the gauge coupling. So there's nothing particularly special. I subtract away the infinity here. What's the problem? The problem is that it is highly sensitive to what the value would be at the coupling. Because if I change this by some amount, well, then I hugely change what I get at low energies. Whereas if I change the strength of dimension four operators, right, by some small amount, I only get logarithmic. Okay. All right. So what's the result? The result is, that dimensionful and in the standard model, there is one or two, depending on how you count. One, this one, two, the cosmological constant. So those are the only two parameters, and so that's why so many of us who work on beyond the standard model worry so much about the Higgs potential, is precisely because of this. Okay. So, good. I could say one more comment, which is And the notion of getting the cutoff sensitivity, the cutoff sensitivity 10 H squared, is straightforward. And actually, I'm now forgetting whether Nima actually explicitly wrote this down or whether Jim did. But of course, you can compute what the cutoff sensitivity is of m h squared versus all of the other parameters of the standard model, namely the electron coupling, or say, the electron and Yukawa coupling, or the gauge couplings. Okay. All of these couplings will scale something that goes like log of q squared, as opposed to the Higgs mass, g squared, momentum, which then depends on this, lambda squared over q squared. That's what we mean by that. So the log sensitivity to the cutoff, whereas the Higgs mass squared explicitly will have a dependence on lambda squared. And you can compute the size. At least you can compute the size from just loops of standard model particles. Right? And these are the classic diagrams. This diagram and this one at one loop. Each one of these is quadratically divergent and sensitive to the cutoff scale squared. The only savior is a 16 pi squared in the denominator, okay, from the loop factor. Geometry helps now and then. And the fact that these couplings here, well, one of them is not, may not be too large, and the other ones are order one. But obviously, the top fork is the worst here. Okay. So this leads to then the usual problem. All right. So this is why the Higgs mass squared is so pervasive in and more generally the electroweak symmetry breaking. Trying to understand the scale is so pervasive in physics beyond the standard model. Okay. Good. So then you can say, great. Well, all right, tell me the answer. How do I solve it? There are, as far as I can tell, three basic approaches to how you can try to solve this problem. Like it, but it is at least a logical possibility that the Higgs mass squared is indeed just fine-tuned. That for some reasons that we do not understand, the Baer contribution, the loop contributions, accidentally sum up to this small. There may be even motivation for that, because after all, as I said, the Higgs mass squared is but one of two dimensional parameters in the standard model, the other one being the cosmological constant. And in its units, it is tuned to a much higher power because it is a dimension 4 constant. So maybe if the cosmological constant is already tuned, the Higgs mass would be tuned. There are different approaches to this. Nima may tell you about one of them. He probably will in later in his supersymmetry lectures, actually. But this goes along the lines of, are there more than one vacuum? Are there so many vacua? There's such a huge density of vacua that perhaps we are but one of them. And this is at least a logical possibility, even if it is one that may be difficult to test, but we don't. But yes. I'm not going to pop on this line. A second possibility is that the cutoff scale of the standard model is simply not large. Now, I have to say this in two ways. Well, you could say the cutoff scale is not large because there's new physics, and new physics takes over and goes from there. No, that is a possibility. That's not the possibility of cutoff. I mean, the true fundamental cutoff of effective field theory is the TEV scale. being that you should stop thinking about it at that point. Point particle field theory ends at a TEV. If this were true, well then, you know, there's no tuning necessary with this, and I don't have to think too hard about this problem. There's a number of puzzles with this. But what I find interesting about this is there is actually an explicit implementation of this idea. Okay. What would be the implementation? Well, we usually think about the cutoff scale of the standard model being beyond which, you know, we think point-particle interactions, can't think about it in those terms, or conversely, that I reach strong coupling that I can't recapture. But strong coupling in a way that I really can't calculate, not just simply, I don't have the computer knowledge to do it. Namely, we usually think about the ultimate cutoff of the theory being where gravity takes over. So there is a possibility that then maybe the standard model we've got right, but gravity we've got wrong, and that the fundamental scale of gravity is a TEV. Okay, this is, or the poster child for this is large extra dimensions. And I'm going to talk about this later. The third approach, of course, is one in which, okay, there is actually some new effective field theory that somehow naturalizes the weak scale. NEMA is telling you about what? Namely, supersymmetry. Supersymmetry promotes the chirality of fermions to scalars. Right? So that the same symmetries that protect against the electron mass where, well, I've got the Yukawa here, but so the electron mass renormalizes as whatever the bare parameter is, plus multiplicatively times the log. Why this way? Because as the electron mass is sent to zero, you enhance the chiral symmetries of the model. Okay? The left and the right-handed components of the electron can be rotated independently. This was the genius of Tilt back in 79 or so when he wrote this down. And he said that theories, or I should say parameters, which have this property, parameters that when you send them to zero, stay zero due to a symmetry reason, are said to be natural. So parameters which you set to zero and stay at zero, so they don't renormalize away from zero because there's a symmetry protecting them, are natural. The Higgs mass squared is not natural. So I can send it to zero, but then renormalize it, rate of correction will regenerate. Why? Because there's no symmetry that is enhanced as the Higgs mass squared goes to zero. So the third basic approach to trying to get to this problem is maybe there's a way of trying to understand how the Higgs mass square itself can be naturalized. And as I say, supersymmetry is one of them. And the others are theories which you understand the electroweak scale as arising in some form or another that. And what we mean by this is something where, for example, like QCD, where you have a coupling that runs down very nicely and then gets strong, generates a scale, okay, dynamically, somehow the Higgs also acquires its mass through some dynamical mechanism. The problem with this is, and NEMA has emphasized this before, we have probed to the TEV scale and beyond in many different aspects, and in particular, electroweak precision measurements, as Jim told you, favor a light Higgs. A light Higgs means what? A light Higgs means the quartic coupling here, this guy, is not too large. That means that the completion of the mod, the Higgs potential itself, doesn't look like it's strongly coupled. So if it doesn't look like it's strongly coupled, how do we understand that we could get dynamical signature breaking out here? Okay, this is a puzzle. But because of the fact that this is itself a strong coupling problem, it may be that we just don't know how to calculate ineffective field theory itself. We don't know how to calculate, meaning we don't know how to put it on the computer, or you know, it takes a long time. And so it's our strong coupling ignorance, which is why we haven't figured out the quote-unquote right theory for this. Okay. All right. Question?
They are small compared to the lambda of the scale of the problem. And when you said it is your ingredient, what's the interest rate? What is that? But then I have trouble here because the lambda of this theorem, particularly the standard model, will be very high. So the fact that the Hyman Fock scale, the fact that the Higgs model was averaged quadratically, still this scale is smaller than lambda of all, so natural mass is not violated.
I'm not sure I understand the question to repeat it.
Okay, so natural states that parameters are small only compared to the lambda of all, for example.
Well, the way I would state it is that I can state it in a more precise way, which is the way that's actually relevant for us for an effective field theory, which is that the parameters are multiplicatively renormalized. And that's a statement about these parameters, when set to zero, stay zero and do not renormalize because there are you enhance the symmetries of the theory.
Maybe my conclusion was in the definition of natural mass because they don't define the definition as well, I guess.
Well, this is the this is as I understand how Tuft defines it. I mean, it's gone through maybe some perturbations, but the way we usually think about natural parameters are ones which send them to zero, you enhance the symmetries of the theory, and then they stay zero, they do not run all this. Correct. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. Yeah. Good. Yeah. Okay, so very good. Okay, so we have different possibilities for where we can go, and then the question is, well, let's pick one and run with it. But what I've really done is only giving you the motivation for step one. Okay, I said there were three things that I expected convergence of. One being electroweak symmetry breaking, the other one being dark matter, the third one being the LHC. Fortunately, with the LHC, I don't have to talk very much about it because we haven't seen anything there yet. But you can at least appreciate that this is a high-energy collider opening up a new energy frontier, and as I explained, new physics may indeed require you to think very carefully about the kind of signal that you can get there. So that's sort of going without question. But the second point, the notion of the connection to dark matter, is the one that I think should be stressed and stressed again. So that's the one I want to talk about before I go off into model land. Any questions?
Okay. So by your definition of natural, is the cosmological process?
No.
So if you said
it doesn't stay zero. Exactly. Yeah. That's why it's the biggest problem that we have, but also the one which we seem to have the least clue about. Okay, so let me talk about the dark matter GED scale connection. It's something that you see this and you see it in different contexts, and then you realize that it actually is one part of a larger connection between basically the early universe and particle physics. You know, everything that we seem to know, a large number of things that we seem to understand about the large scale structure of the universe apparently came from microscopic quantities. So the relationships between what we observe now and how we can run that back in time and hence run it up in energy means that we can get a lot of information about particle physics just by understanding properties that we see in the universe today. What do we know? Well, we know if you go back far enough, the universe was hotter, more dense, etc. You already know of examples where particle physics had a direct impact, something happened, and then as the universe cooled, it became dilute, and then some particles decoupled. Right? This is the connection between dark matter and TeV, but you already know that this type of thing happened before with other particles. One example of this transition is at a temperature of about an eV, or conversely, a time of about 300,000 years, and something like that. Correct me if I got the number right, but this is close enough. At this stage, what happened? Well, atoms formed. And the universe became neutral. Neutral to photon propagation. And so eventually, photons can propagate from the plasma, and out they go. Right, this is our classic CMB. So this is an example, or the first example, of a case where from the early universe, you have some hot plasma, it cools down, becomes dilute, and eventually some particles decouple. And then we observe them, and we have gained an enormous amount of information about the universe from observing these photons, and hence observing the universe at this era. Right? But this is one of a number of transitions. Another transition happened somewhere around an NEV. Because at this stage, and it's a wonderful, amusing exercise. If you haven't already done it or seen it before, you can sit down and in 30 seconds to 1 minute compute this scale. So it's very nice in that way. You can sit down and compute this scale, just from effective field theory, very quickly, that this is the scale where weak interactions froze out or decoupled. It's called freeze out. And by that we mean, of course, that the interaction rate of weak interactions, the interaction rate of particles through weak interactions became smaller than that of the expansion of the universe. And so then protons and neutrons would no longer be exchanged between one another, et cetera. So whatever you're left with, whatever amount of protons and neutrons you're left with, would then form nuclei and then go from there. This, of course, is the stage of nucleosynthesis. These are already two of the most powerful pieces of evidence that we have for the nature of the early universe and that the standard model is functioning exactly as we expected it. Why? Because, for example, in this particular case, the expansion rate of the universe depends on the number of relativistic degrees of freedom at the time that weak interactions decouple. So what's relativistic at an NEV? You can just start to count, right? So we've got photons and relativistic and, I should say, thermally coupled. So you've got photons. You could say, well, what about gravitons? No, gravitons aren't coupled at that stage. They're too weakly interacting. Neutrinos. They're lighter than this, for sure. You can think about how we know that, but we do. So neutrinos, electrons barely, and that's about it. So if there were a larger number of light neutrinos that were coupled, thermally coupled to the plasma at that stage, we would have seen the expansion of the universe be a little bit faster. And that would change the predictions for nucleosynthesis. It would actually, if I remember this right, increase the amount of helium for it. So it's something that you can try to go out and measure and pin down. These days, the best measurements of nucleosynthesis come from deuterium, from the earliest that people can observe it, which is through quasar absorption. It's about ratio to 5. So fortunately, at a time before most stellar processing occurred, so you have some reliable information. Okay, so nucleosynthesis synthesis provides another window onto early universe physics, but that is really where it ends for the standard model. Before an MEV, pretty much anything can go. We don't know. We don't have any probes of that earlier beyond, well. Okay. So what's the dark matter connection? Well, just as particles were once in thermal equilibrium and then froze out, and then you get some abundance of them and some properties that you can observe for each of these quantities, the same thing is thought to happen, or may happen, for dark matter. So the picture is that at some early time, everything was in thermal equilibrium, namely the standard model particles, plus a hypothetical weakly interacting part. So, how does this work? Well, first we need to understand what are the interactions of WIMPs with standard model. And I haven't told you what the WIMP is, I haven't told you anything about it yet. Fortunately, we don't have to know that much about it to get the argument right. First, the relevant thing to do is to just think about, okay, well, what kind of WIMP is appropriate? Well, obviously something that has to be stable. So that means that it must come in pairs, because if I had interactions with the standard model of just one WIMP and it's massive, that would lead to a potential decay. So it has to come in pairs. So whatever the interaction is, I've got two of them. What do I want to call them? Call them chis, for no particular reason. And then we're assuming that this is somehow interacting with the standard model. There are different ways that it could potentially interact with the standard model. But what we're primarily interested in is a regime at and below the weak scale. Now, why do I say it that way? It's because presumably there's some very hot thermal plasma. As we cool down, these interactions are still going, they're still exchanging back and forth, and you have to cool a long way before you can finally have these interactions be of order the expansion rate of the universe. Why is that? Well, again, because remember the number density of photons in the early universe was really high, right? The baryon to photon ratio is 10 to the minus 10 or so, which means most of the stuff in the early universe is, you know, all this plasma, photons, etc. So the primary interactions then we can write down here are, would be then those, the standard model fields. And by standard model, I mean things that are, you know, say, light or numerous, like baryons. If you take this and run with this, and you can show for explicit WIMPs, this is exactly what happens. Okay. What is this process? Well, now it depends on some details, like is this a fermion, is it a scalar, etc. Let's just for fun, let's for fun say it's a fermion. And then this interaction is just, if I can write it schematically anyway, pi squared f standard model squared divided by some scale. Well, if this is an effective field theory, there's the scale. But we actually know what this scale has to be for this interaction, because it's going to be something that is characteristic of the scale of the interactions that are going on here. And those are going to be the mass of the particle. That's assuming that it already has weak interactions and we integrate it out, you know, and go to energies. This would be true for, say, a mass of chi that is larger than approximately, say, the electron scale. And that's sort of the picture I have in the back of my mind. Once you just write down this interaction, then it's straightforward to compute the cross-section from this result. And the relevant cross-section for the early universe is one in which you multiply by velocity and you thermally average. And I'll show you what I mean by this. If you do this, if you just compute the cross-section and thermally average for for low temperatures, then you find that this cross-section will go like, and I'm going to be very curious with this, I'm going to write it as, say, g to the fourth, 32 pi m pi squared. Where what I've secretly done is imagine that the interactions between the guys to the fermions are through, say, SU2 interactions. Okay, so secretly what it was something like this. We have chi, f, f. And we've gone to low temperatures, we've gone to low temperatures. So the dominant mass scale in the problem is the mass of the chi. This is where this interaction comes from. There were two powers of g on each side. I then square it to get the cross section, hence g to the fourth, and I put in some judicious little fun. Pi, 32, for fun. All right, so then if I have this interaction, then I can say, well, when did the wimp freeze out? When for how long was it in thermal equilibrium when did it freeze out? This occurs when the Hubble scale is a border, the interaction strength or the annihilation rate of the WIMPs. And this interaction rate, or which Nemo wrote as an inverse length, is just sigma v times number density of chi. Okay, so we know what this quantity is, or I've told you what it is for this particular particle. The Hubble expansion rate, we also know what it is, because in radiation domination, you can just compute it directly from Einstein's equations. And it goes like the temperature of the plasma divided by m phi, temperature squared divided by m phi. So what I can do from this is to try to compute what is the freeze-out abundance that I get. Now, to do that, it turns out that the easiest thing is to do a trick. Nima did it quickly. I'm going to do it again. The trick is that, well, the problem to compare these two rates is that this number density is changing with time, and so, you know, how do I factor all of that in? But fortunately, the number density of chi divided by the entropy is a conserved quantity, at least so long as I don't have any new sources of heat, no entropy delta. So what we can do is compute the abundance of these chi's directly from this. Maybe what I will do is do it. So we want to compute the abundance, which is n chi, or the actual density of the particles, which is the mass times n chi, which is what it would be for a non-relativistic particle. But what's more interesting is to take a ratio between n chi, and the critical density. Compare the two, because this is, in the end, what we have the best knowledge of. This is we know this quantity very well, so everything is expressed in terms. So it's very useful to get used to seeing it in this terms. If I write this out, I can rewrite this as m chi times n chi divided by the entropy times, say, the entropy divided by rho critical. So, if what I want is the relic density measured today, then what I would need to do is to plug in all of these quantities today. So the relic density, with the number density today, the mass is whatever the mass is. We hope it's not changing with the expansion of the universe. For most dark matter, it doesn't happen. And we would want this today. So, today. And technically, I would put today's on the other quantities. But, as I said, n chi over the entropy is conserved. So this I can take to be at whatever era I like, and it is most convenient to use the quantity that is obtained at freezing, which we can determine fairly easily. And then if I choose to obtain this quantity at freeze out, then I'm taking all of these quantities measured today. So I could take all of these quantities measured today, but this is an invariant, and scale that back up to the freeze out and compute the abundance. So let's do this. So S, the entropy, is, do I want to put G stars in? Not really. E cubed. There's a G star in front. The number density of chi's is from up there, Hubble, divided by sigma v. So this is roughly, if I evaluate this thing at the freeze-out, this is whatever temperature the universe was at the freeze-out. X squared divided by sigma v m Planck, just plugging in for Hubble. And then if I take these quantities and put it into here, I end up with m chi over t freeze out 1 over sigma v thermal average 1 over m Planck times two quantities. S naught, the entropy is measured today, and the critical density is measured today. These quantities are things we already know. We can just go and look them up. You can go to your favorite copy of Colvin Turner and just read them right off. Or you can think how we got the mass or physically. I'm going to read them off of Colvin Turner, and what I get is these real numbers in the end, 2890. I'm sorry for the small print here. 2890 in units of inverse centimeters cubed. That is a density, after all. And then the critical density, which you can also think about in whatever units you like, you know it has to be of order the cosmological constant, which you know has to be roughly 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 3 electron volts, all quantity to the fourth power, which I can rewrite as about 5, 10 to the minus 6 GeV times, I'm sorry if you can't see that, but all right, the point. What did we get from doing this exercise? We got then that the relic density of the WIMPs, as measured today, is some numerical values that I can work out here. Remember, this is some density. There's a density here that cancels. There's a scale. Did I get all the right? Yeah, I did. Good. So there's two scales in the denominator, two mass scales. That corresponds to a length scale squared in the numerator. That looks awfully like a cross section, which is handy to know that the dimensions work out of this. Yeah. And then this is just some quantity, the mass of the particle divided by free zone. When you solve the Boltzmann equation, you can figure out what this quantity is. Nemus started to do it. Typically, it's in the neighborhood of the mass divided by the temperature is in the neighborhood of 20 to 30 or so. And since it's only logarithmically sensitive to this quantity, the estimate I get out of here is not going to depend sensitively on that. So I put in the numbers for all of this. And what I get is, for that cross section I have up at the top that you can barely see, 0.2 times m chi divided by 1 keV squared. Now, go look up WMAP, and you see omega or omega h squared, which is sometimes the way it's quoted, h being the Hubble constant in units of, what is it, 100 kilometers per megaparsec per second, or something like that. H is typically about 0.7-ish or so. You square it, that's 1/2. So then omega h squared is 0.1 times this quantity, and if you look up the WMAP paper to see what the value you get is, it's 0.1. So weakly interacting particles with a roughly weak scale mass end up with a relic abundance today that is exactly in line with what you expect. And I didn't have to do almost anything to get this out. I'm doing the same type of calculation that we do here that resulted in all of the joy of CMB and nuclear synthesis. So this is a powerful connection between the possibility of weakly interacting particles and the TEP state. There are some caveats to this, and if I have time tomorrow, which I doubt I will, so I'm going to make two comments on it right now, and that may be the end only due to time. This is obviously tantalizingly close, and this is very nice. And of course, you can see I put in various factors and numbers and such things, and so you'd say, well, you know, of order of TEV, this seems to be right. When you actually really do the calculation for real, you find that indeed you do get of order of TEV scale out in the theory. This is a little bit troubling because this is still not the weak scale. Okay, well, it has the advantage that it's a little bit above the scales we've already probed experimentally, so maybe that means it's still viable, okay? But it is nevertheless still a little bit above the weak scale. So the question then is that a problem? Do I care about that? Well, not necessarily, because how could I imagine that this would be smaller? I could imagine it would be smaller if the annihilation cross-section here, which depends on g to the fourth over n chi squared. So what does that mean? It means that I could reduce the mass of the dark matter particle if at the same time I reduce the strength of the interaction. And you can see, since it goes like g to the fourth, right, I don't have to decrease it very much before the mass goes down. Naively, that makes it look good. The problem is that you typically have to, you know, you have to reduce it by this amount. It has to be sub-weakly interacting for this to be of order 100 GeV or smaller, okay, for this to go. That's slightly puzzling. There's another puzzle, which I'll just state in words, because you might hear about it from some of the dark matter detection talks that I think are coming, but I'll state it anyway because it's here and it's something that in physics beyond the standard model people have just begun thinking about. So it's one of those things you want to jump into a topic and start thinking this is a place for it. Well, the relic abundance came out to be about the right number here. You can see that this scattering cross-section, two guys, two fermions, if I were to then have a halo of, I've got a halo of dark matter around the galaxy, it has some distribution, it's got some, as our spiral arm is going around the galaxy, it's sweeping out the dark matter haze, very much like when you walk in the rain, you know. Unlike the rain, though, the rain actually hits you and stops, the dark matter on average is going flying right through you. But occasionally, some of those dark matter particles can hit and interact, and you can try to observe them. You can try to observe the recoil energy of a dark matter particle hit, okay, and off it goes. I mean, it's basically very much like how neutrinos are detected in the underground observatories, and that led to our revolution in near standing neutrino masses. Well, this quantity up there, if I now apply the dark matter scattering to some atom in some well-defined controlled environment, which I can measure recoil energies extremely well, I can try to get at this. The problem is that these experiments that have probed the dark matter detection, and the two of the best right now are Xenon, X-E-N-O-N, and CDMS. These are two experiments that are searching for the direct detection of dark matter off nuclei, okay, have probed cross-sections that are far sub-weakly interacting. Numerically, the value is, I think, 10 to the minus 43 centimeters squared. A weak interaction, by the way, is about 10 to the minus 39 or 38 or something like that. Okay. So they've probed interactions that are far sub-weakly interacting and haven't seen any detection. So this is puzzling, because here you've got a wonderful argument for why you should see a weakly interacting particle, weak scale mass, weak, you know, yet we haven't found it yet. Puzzling. This is something that's come out only, I would say, in the last two, 3, 4 years or so. Okay. All right. Good. Any questions on this before I switch gears.
Here you see that the entropy is the number density of an entropy is conserved if there's no new degrees of freedom are produced in the universe. But is this the case at this scale?
Not only approximately so, but the number is an order one. You can think about the degrees of freedom that have decoupled and decayed, and there is a modification. Just like, so you can think about it from the following way. Think about the effect that happened after, so after E plus E minus annihilation occurred through, coincidentally around this same scale, then the E plus E minus dumped a little bit of energy into photons, okay, causing the photons to end up being a little bit higher temperature than, say, neutrinos, which you didn't come out from annihilation of E plus E minus. Okay? So the slight difference there is 3 degrees or so for photons and 2 degrees for neutrinos. So there's an order one number, and that's the same type of thing that happens here. So you have to do that to get this number accurately. You have to go through that.
For that, I couldn't follow what assumptions you made. Did you make M chi and the result temperature to be at the same order?
No. So what I did one thing quickly, which I stated only in words, which was that you actually have to solve the Boltzmann equation to determine the ratio of the mass to freeze-out temperature. And what you find when you do that is that this quantity is of order 20 to 30. And it only depends logarithmically on this ratio. So even if I change the mass by an order of magnitude, I only change this actual quantity by an order one number. So I didn't need to know to get this to be in. To get this to be a squiggle, okay, I didn't need to know this more precisely.
Also, G is at the order of 1.
G, yeah, what I actually took for this was G of 0.65, which is the weak interaction strength evaluated in the Z-mass.
But then G is a Newtonian formation, not adjusted. The freeze-out temperature will be of the order of the Wick strength.
The freeze-out temperature will be of order of the, it'll be a little bit below the weak scale. So if it's, say, 25, and the particle is a TeV, then it's like, 40 GeV. But you're right, it's close. And so then you have to determine the interaction. But remember, this interaction is going to be dominated by the mass of the particle rather than the mass of the Z, because this is the largest mass in the problem, and it's occurring at a time when these particles are non-relativistic. Okay, I stress this connection, and I go through this because in some ways I really do think that this is the strongest connection between these different scales. Alas, we have models, supersymmetry and other things, to try to provide candidates for dark matter, to try to understand the electroweak scale. They lead to all sorts of amusing consequences at the LHC, which is good and useful. None of them is so compelling that everyone's working on one thing. And that should tell you something. Okay. So what I want to do now, though, is to actually talk about some specific proposals and to see what sort of consequences you get out of them. And it gives you not so much as this is the way the world is absolutely necessarily working, but this is an example of how the world might work and then what the consequences would be. I want to talk about, it's not there, is it? Oh, I erased it, didn't I? Did I erase it? I erased it. Wow. I want to talk about point number two, the possibility of This proposal, large extra dimensions, originally done by one of our lecturers and two of his colleagues, Neva, is a proposal that tries to lower the effective quantum gravity scale, to modify gravity so as to have the true cutoff scale of the theory being near a TEV scale. That's the goal. That's what you want to do. OK. So let me define a term so that you have it once and for all in your mind. There is a scale M Planck, which is 2×10^18 TeV. Every time I write M Planck, I mean this number. And what I'm going to call M star, which refers to the new quantum gravity scale. I will be more precise about what I mean, where the scale comes in just a moment, but just to avoid confusion, because you're going to see both quantities all over the place. It's just stated once and for all at a time. This quantity M Planck is always this number. This is the one that we hope will be, we can arrange to be near the TeV scale. So the hope is that the cutoff scale of the theory is the quantum gravity scale, which is in some way lower than the TeV. You might say, wait a second. I heard yesterday from Nima that we have all sorts of ways to probe beyond the TeV scale. The standard model has a series of accidental symmetries, those being baryon number, lepton number, global Flegler symmetries, as well as even constraints on operators that don't have any obvious connection to particular violations of symmetries, such as compositeness bounds as a dark cone. And all of these don't seem to indicate any new physics. So, well, you know, for example, the big one, say this operator. Okay, where I'm being very quick about what I about how I write this, but what I mean by this is the interaction of two quark two lepton or two three quarks one lepton field dimension six operator leading to a violation of baryon number and lepton number each by one. Right? This quantity leads to proton decay, and if I actually put a one here in front and I compute what's the bound on lambda, just with a numerical value of 1 in front, you find lambda has to be larger than something like 10 to the 15 to the 16. So that suggests that this better not be generated in your theory of physics beyond the standard model, for if it is, it's ruled out by proton decay already. There's two approaches to this. Well, the first thing is that one can hope that there is a mechanism for trying to understand the stability or the conservation of baryon and lepton number. There are ways to do that in large extra dimensions that I may mention one or two a little later. Okay. This same type of problem also exists, though, potentially in supersymmetry. There is an operator in supersymmetry that looks awfully like this, except that it's now, except that it's now superfields, and it actually is a dimension 5 operator in the way you write it in supersymmetry, and it leads, again, to this similar problem. So most models of physics beyond the standard model generically can have problems with violations of global symmetries. This is one for baryon and lepton number violation. There are also operators leading to Flegler violations, so the sort of, how do I want to write this? Four fermions, all standard model, but now one, two, or something like that. Oscillations between different generations. Okay? And again, these quantities are also strongly restricted, the scale being, as Nina was telling you, between 300 to 3000 TeV if there's an order one coefficient. Again, this quantity was naively looks like it's in bad shape if the cutoff scale of the theory is very low, but you will find that the same type of operators here that show up also potentially show up in supersymmetry, and when you do general suffering, and Nima will tell you about that. So most models of physics beyond the standard model actually potentially have problems with these things. The approach you can take to this is, number one, first, just start, move, see how far you can get, and see if you can find or rule out the idea, even before you worry about the violation of these global symmetries. Because after all, whatever this violation is, it's due to the cutoff scale effect, which I don't know. So I might be lucky. Okay? It could be that due to some the nature of the cutoff scale theory, I don't violate baryon and electron. I don't know. And what it depends on is it depends on how my theory is complete. So what I'm stating is that lowering the cutoff scale to a TEB, effectively modifying gravity to cause this to happen, does lead potentially to these problems. And then there's two statements to it. One is, well, we're aware of them, so we'll set that aside and move, and then we can come back to it. And that's the approach we're going to take. That's actually the approach you have to take, as I say, supersymmetry is the approach you have to take in Technicolor and in other models of physics. Okay, what is the picture then to get this result? The picture is that sort of pictures before. Here's our here's our 4D spacetime, and we have some number of extra dimensions, large, of which I'll tell you what I mean by large in a second. These are, say, something like this, look like a torus. If I have n number of extra dimensions, the assumption being that the modification we're doing is only a modification of gravity, so that the standard model, the Higgs, the fermions, all of the standard model, lives fixed to this surface in the extra-dimensional spacetime, and that only gravity propagates in these extra dimensions. From an effective field theory point of view, you're just doing this by fiat. You're saying, this is what I'm going to do, and you move from there. Nevertheless, there are variations, string theory, et cetera, that you can see how to localize fermions and gauge fields to surface interaction relations. And the string theorists in the audience are going to be more expert at this than I am. Nevertheless, it's enough to simply state, from a low-energy effective field theory point of view, that you can put the quantity on the battery. Yeah?
So is this like completely string theory inspired, or are you just taking, like, can you actually derive it from some 10-dimensional string theory, or are you just taking some ingredients?
The simplest answer to your question is I'm simply taking ingredients. I'm just doing effective field theory, and I'm not doing more than that. More specifically, I'm saying I've got a standard model and a delta function, okay, that fixes the fields to the surface. How do I get that? There are ways to get it, okay, and that's a whole industry in itself. Okay? But the joy of effective field theory is that those quantities are high energy degrees of freedom, typically high energy degrees of freedom that I can integrate out. And if I'm at scales much suppressed compared to this, I can work in a suppressed energy.
But it's not automatically guaranteed that you can't get it from strict theory.
Now I'm going to state some, okay, since you pressed me on this a second time, I will now state the next statement, which is, I'm not aware of anything you can't get from string theory.
Well, I mean, I know there is a bad
and so for that reason is why I don't have, why I as an effective field theorist don't think more. So, but that's my perspective, and I'm not, that's not, By the way, that is not to say that I don't think it's important or useful to study those questions, because there may be, in fact, some inevitabilities of when you try to put it in string theory. It's just that, from a perspective of working at low energies, this is the perspective.
The fact that we have a large number of factors doesn't necessarily mean that it's easy to really build a specific one.
Absolutely, and many people have tried different variations to do this. As I say, there are ways to do it, just as there are ways to get ADS backgrounds, the Randall-Sundrum models, et cetera, out, and that's its own topic, which I'm going to leave for a string phenomenologist to talk about. All right, so this is the picture by Fiat, as I say, standard model on a brain, some number of extra dimensions. From the perspective of what is the action for gravity, well, this is easy. We just integrate, as usual, over all of the four usual large four space-time dimensions that are as large as the universe, and then some number of dimensions that we assume are compact. If I do this for n-dimensional gravity, it will have an n-dimensional metric factor. It has given a space, and n-dimensional Ricci scalar associated with it, the usual two derivatives of the metric now depending on many different components. But I'm going to take the assumption that this metric factorizes into two pieces, that of the four dimensions and that of the extra dimensions, and that these dimensions are flat space. And that simplifies life greatly. If you don't do that, you end up with more interesting ideas, like the Randall-Sundrum model.
There's something like differential hydraulic separations, there's something that exists in this model.
Oh, I haven't got the scales yet. Sorry, what?
The high energies rate on the Hallmark model, right? And with low energies, then on the display. So when you say that you can separate these, you say that you can separate these arrives from the right.
Well, I haven't told you any of the scales yet, but you're right that I am going to end up having this being at low energies. But it's probably better to wait, hold that thought for a little bit. Yeah. All right. So here's the action, and up until this point, all I need to do is just add in the scale associated with this. And what's the scale? Well, again, we just do the usual counting. The action is dimensionless. This is minus 4 in dimensions. This is minus n in however number of dimensions I've got. This is two derivatives of a metric. So then I can figure out how many powers of some scale I have to put in here. And here is where the joyous n star comes in. So it comes in with how many powers? Well, it's going to be the number of dimensions, which is 4 plus n minus 2. So n plus 2. I'm going to check to make sure I didn't. Fantastic. All right. Yeah. All right. The picture then is that if n of these dimensions are compact, then we can identify the space as yi, where here are the coordinates of the extra dimension, I being from 1 to n. And I'm just taking a sort of an ordinary torus for this. Identify them as through periodic boundary conditions, going back and forth. If I do that, then assume that this space-time dimensions over here are flat, then I can just decompose all of these pieces, integrate out the extra dimensions, and result in a low-energy action. That's straightforward to do. So you end up with d4x. If there is no if the space-time is flat in the extra dimensions, and I'm interested in just getting the low-energy effects, classical gravity, this thing will go over into whatever it is for R4 plus the flat piece. This thing will also factorize into its two pieces, and so I will result in root D4, some choice of metric for whether I have a plus or minus sign, M star, the famous scale, N plus 2. I integrate over the extra dimensions, and so I get out a volume factor, which is just this 2 pi r to the nth power, integrate around, times R4. And you'll recognize this to be exactly the 4D action for gravity, but where the Planck scale is identified as this. So the 4D Planck scale, the usual Planck scale that we have, is identified as whatever this new quantum gravity scale is to this power times the volume. So if the volume here were of the same size as the TEV scale, say, why did I say the TEV scale? That's not what I wanted. That's right. Back up a second. If this scale were of the same size as, say, of order the Planck scale, sort of you're thinking string theory, compact dimensions all way up at a high scale, then this is of order m Planck to some power. Here's m Planck on this side. You can figure out that the only thing that's going to work here is going to be when this is of order m Planck. Okay, so you don't modify the scale dramatically if the size of the extra dimensions is of the same order. But the interesting thing here is that if the volume of the extra dimensions is actually much larger, or as a scale is much smaller than the Planck scale, then m star ends up being itself much smaller than the Planck scale. Okay? The effect of this relation is one of these joyous things. It's like you stare at this for a while and. Yes. Absolutely. Hence the Randall-Sundrum model as one data point of something that is very interesting when it doesn't factorize.
Can you do that integration straightforward for the factorizing?
Not as straightforwardly, but you can still do it. Absolutely. You can always do it. Okay? It's just a matter of. Good. It's a good point. Okay, so what we can do then is we end up with a situation where here we have gravity governed by this scale, which is really weak, right? Weak scale gravity governed by interactions that go like 1 over m Planck, after all. Right? You solve Einstein's equations, T mu nu over m Planck. Okay. Weak gravity is then whatever this new scale is, which we're hoping to be a TEV, and then we end up here with a large volume. So the intuitive picture is that gravity is the interactions of gravity are weak to us because the graviton rarely intersects with the spring. It's mostly propagating in the extra dimensions. And only due to its small overlap, if you like, the overlap of its wave function is the reason why it has an interaction strength that appears to be small. You can compute now, and this is where the fun begins, is that you can compute the size of the extra dimensions that you need to get so that this is, in fact, weak, or this for this to work. So let me do that, just to give you a feeling for the scales of this. Okay. The easiest thing is to just tabulate. So let me just do that. The number of extra dimensions: 1, 2, 3, and off we go. And the volume, or let's take the radius. So what I can do here is, obviously these dimensions could be of different size, but I assumed they all to be the same size, just for simplicity, so that I could compute quickly and end up with this result. But obviously you can even guess yourself how this is going to scale if this is different. But assuming that the dimensions are of all the same size, and then I had some number of extra dimensions as I go like this, I can compute the scale, the size, the volume of this space that it has to be such that this relation works for a TEV scale mass. So R for M star equal to 1 TEV. For 1, well, you can sort of see how this goes. M Planck squared, this is a TEV now to the third power. So what I need to do is to take M Planck, well, 1 over a TEV gives me a scale, M Planck over a TEV, which is 10 to the 15 quantity squared, multiply it through, I get a distance, extract it out, and you find it is 10 AUs, astronomical units, or 10 to the 12 meters. Okay, so a huge distance. As you make the volume of the space larger, as you increase the number of dimensions, there's more space for the graviton to propagate, and so you don't need to make the space-time as big to go through. So as I then go to 2 dimensions, I've already dropped to 1 millimeter. To 3 dimensions, it's roughly 10 nanometers, just for fun. 6 is up at about 0.1. I have, well, 10 to the minus 11 meters. What is this, 0.1 angstroms? Okay. So quickly, the scale goes from a large scale gravitation, you know, large at the scale of planets, down in this way. Okay. Obviously, if we modify gravity by adding an extra dimension, you modify the force law, and you modify other aspects of even just classical gravity. Yeah, I'll tell you more about that in next time. But what I'll do is say that clearly this one is not going to work phenomenologically. This way of doing it doesn't work. There are n models of extra dimensions, and other models work for their own peculiar reasons, which we can talk about afterward. But from the point of view of the setup that I just did here thus far, this doesn't work. From this setup, it doesn't work. Now, these subsequent possibilities, whether they work or not, is something that then you have to go and look at the experiment and test it. And the remarkable thing is that up until not that long ago, the best tests of gravity at short distances were actually tests down to 1 millimeter. So when this whole proposal was given in 1998, the gravity had only been tested down to about 1 millimeter, allowing this possibility to be viable. Now, tests of gravity, so tests of short distance, well, I don't know what you want to call it, but this is short distance for gravity. Tests of short distance gravity have probed down to about 50 microns, and they have not seen any deviation from a, you know, 1 over r squared force law. Okay, and so as a consequence, even this scenario for this particular choice of scale also doesn't work. But clearly this one and others does appear to go. Next time what I'll do is I'll tell you a little bit more about this. The consequences for LHC, and probably what I'll do for your exercise, which I'm told I should give you next time, is to see some consequences of how this works. All right, thanks.